are listening to the Fundamentalist Podcast.
Until the light takes us, am I right, Bog?
Oui.
Hello, everyone. Welcome into the Fundamentalist Podcast. I am your host, Dual Guest, and on this edition of the show, we're taking an under-the-knife look, a deep dive into one of the most famous bands in the history of heavy fucking metal. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Slayer. However, Slayer, their career has spanned multiple decades, so many decades, in fact, that we've had to split this under-the-knife into two. So on this episode, we are going to start with their debut release, Show No Mercy, and go all the way up through Seasons in the Abyss, which was released in 1990. In this episode, you will see us talk about landmark releases such as Show No Mercy. And let's be real, every release that Slayer puts out on this episode is a landmark release, whether it's their EP Haunting the Chapel, Hell Awaits, Rain and Blood, South of Heaven, Seasons in the Abyss. Pretty much everything Slayer did during this decade turned to gold. They could do no fucking wrong. It's hard to find a band with a more unfuckwithable catalog, and I know that word is tainted on this podcast now, but a more unfuckwithable decade than Slayer in the 1980s through 1990. So, without further ado, this is the Fundamentalist Podcast presents Under the Knife, Slayer. And with that, I turn it over to my co-hosts, Peter Bogg, and the ringleader, the host of this edition, Richard Donahue.
First, I'll correct you as fucking Slayer! Anyways, the name Slayer elicits many mental images. Visions of burning, desolate hellscapes filled with pain and misery. Upside-down crosses and pentagrams. Some white trash troglodyte yelling, Slayer! With all that in mind, it's no doubt that Slayer has left a massive impression on the metal scene, influenced thousands of bands with their unmatched intensity, darkness, and occasional missteps here and there, as you'll see. The band themselves was formed in L.A. by Kerry King and Jeff Hanneman, who were schoolmates and met through their joint love of Priest and Maiden, and they were later followed by Dave Lombardo, who was a pizza guy at the time, and confronted Kerry, asking him if he was the guy with all the guitars, to which Kerry was like, yeah, I guess so. I have a guitar too. So they started jamming, and then later Tom Araya joined the band.
Not to start the snark too early, but do you think Jeff Hanneman realized that he smoked Kerry King from day one, or did that take some time to manifest?
Whoa, damn.
Possibly, but Jeff seemed to be a pretty humble type of guy. So if you did think that, he probably didn't verbalize that out loud.
You have all these guitars, bro, but I'm not hearing you play.
Anyways, so the band, being from Orange County, saw all the glam scene in L.A. and hated it to the extreme, which is very understandable. I wanted to do everything they could to be the exact opposite of that, which is more likely why in the early days they were wearing makeup, eyeliner, or as Tom put it, wearing makeup like men, quote unquote. But very shortly thereafter, kind of quit doing that for a more street aesthetic instead. And they started playing local shows, as a band of this nature does, playing mostly covers and whatnot with two or three originals. But the first couple of tours they did were literally in Tom's Camaro and a U-Haul, where, as Tom would put it, you get to the gig, you're drinking, you do your set, you're drinking after, then you're driving to the next show, and then so on and so forth. But things changed for them in 1983, where they were opening for the female-fronted heavy metal band Bitch, who was kind of an underground thing at the time. And this band called Brian Slagle was in the audience. And he, at the time, had just started Metal Blade Records. And he was incredibly impressed by their set and went to approach them to see if they wanted to be on Metal Massacre 3. and the band took it into consideration. And before they did, they bought Metal Massacre One and were listening to it. They're like, well, you know, we can be heavier than that. No, we can be faster than that band. And as the four piece, they wrote the very first Slayer song, which is Aggressive Perfector. Any thoughts on that particular song?
So that was their first song that they ever fucking wrote, and it didn't go on the first record?
Apparently so.
Wild.
I had always wondered if that was some kind of rights thing, because it was released later on the, you know, aforementioned Metal Massacre. Released
twice.
Well, it was released and then re-recorded, right, on the Rain and Blood, not to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but...
I mean, so obviously they had an affinity for that song to go on not one, but two different recordings. As you said, not to get too far ahead, and I don't want to take us too far on a diversion here. I'm just surprised to hear that that was the first song that they ever recorded, if that was indeed true, considering it's nowhere to be found on Show No Mercy. And stylistically, it's fairly different from the stuff you hear on Show No Mercy as well.
For certain, no, they were very proud of the song. They would practice it literally multiple times a day. So when they did record, it was just perfect. So yeah, but that's kind of set the template up, as Tom put it, for their future goings on. Anyways, another, before I go any further, I do want to the rumor that I fell for, that they were originally called Dragon Slayer before being called Slayer, which is a film that came out in 1981. But according to Carey himself, we never were. It's a myth to this day. And Lombardo as well said they were almost called Wings of Fire, which sounds like a badass fucking European power metal band, before they ultimately went with Slayer, thankfully. And
yeah, Wings of Fire just wouldn't hit the same.
No, not at all. Not direct enough, not to the point enough. But after listening to Metal Massacre 3, after putting out Aggressive Perfector on Metal Massacre 3, they started to get a buzz around the band. So shortly thereafter, Brian Slagle signed them to Metal Blade Records. And in December of 1983, they put out their very first record, Show No Mercy.
One, I really like it. Duh. But secondly, I'm a little sad that we only got one album of this new wave of British heavy metal influence Slayer. Like, the no album influences continue, you know, for a few albums after this, but this one is, you know, straight out of the vein. This could have been a Merciful Fate record with some different vocals. And speaking of vocals, it's also Tom Arise. I think it's one of his best. I think Bog and I are always talking about how much the Araya falsetto is one of our favorites in metal, but it's like a fucking cryptid. It's like the fucking Bigfoot tape. It shows up like really briefly, and it's just everyone talking about this one or two instances and how cool it was. And it kind of disappears after a while, but it's here on this record in full. And I just really love the kind of bouncy energy. I love how Iron Maiden songs or Iron Maiden influenced songs like Tormentor are.
Yes.
Ryonyx is super maiden-y too. Yeah.
Or just how much fun songs like Die by the Sword or The Antichrist are.
Yes.
That's my initial reaction to this record. One, how fun it is, and just how classically influenced metal-wise that it is. But considering it came out in, 1983, I mean, what else were they going to be influenced by metal-wise? That's what was popular.
I think that, you know, this is still a step towards the extremity side of extreme metal, because it's a lot about Satan, you know, and I'm trying to think of what else in 83 was so prevalent, you know, when talking about being Satan's soldier, you know, the Antichrist and, you know, et cetera, like that. I think, you know, the first three tracks are all about just worshiping Satan, being his soldier. And I looked for it myself, and I don't know if you have any information on this, Richard, but like, where did that come from? You know, because they seemingly were kind of the first American band that I am aware of that leaned into this so much. And I think it's maybe one of the reasons why sometimes people, although this was a controversial take that I said on the air a blue moon or many moons ago, but potentially proto black metal, you know, in that regard, because they Satanism here influenced later Satanism is in death metal, which is where it made the leap over to sort of Europe at that point.
I thought it was Merciful Fate would be where that influence came from.
Yeah. When did the first Merciful Fate record come out? Melissa, was it the same year as this? And then Under Oath came out in 86, right? Although I will say it's probably dangerous for me to start throwing dates out there, considering how notoriously terrible I've been with that in the past. So,
yeah, I'm pretty sure that Sepultura's first record came out about this time.
Yeah, I was pretty blackened, pretty necro, to put it mildly.
The first Merciful Fate record came out in 81, so two years prior to this. So they could very well have been an influence on this. That, like, I feel like it's fairly undeniable, both in Tom Araya's vocal stylings and just high, like, if you listen to it, musically speaking. Like, if three bands, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Merciful Fate, who do they sound like the most in this record? It's Merciful Fate for 8 songs out of 10, and then Iron Maiden for the other two.
For the other two, yeah.
But yeah, as far as my research I came up with, Care is just into horror movies and whatnot, so horror fantasy stuff like that, and Satan's and all that, especially the B-side, like terrible B-movies and whatnot, so I'm sure that was also an influence as well. This record for me, this is my first venture in the early Slayer was doing this, and it's very upbeat, it's very strange, but it's very good though. I liked it a lot more than I expected, though the drums, to me, they're real. They sound programmed. They don't almost sound like an actual drummer to me. It sounds like a drum machine, but it is Lombardo playing on it. So,
you know, I would say that the lack of the double bass pedal on this record is super evident. And, you know, I think it was something that was simply not widely available or used at that point, considering what an influence Lombardo was on so many later metal drummers himself. I think that was one of the things I noted in particular when I was thinking about the new wave of British heavy metal influences, was how the drums didn't seem to necessarily always propel the heaviness of the riffs or the speed of the riffs that I think that they were trying to as much as they did even just the following year on the upcoming EP.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct. And a lot of things that we take for granted in the world of heavy metal, especially in the extreme subgenres, originated primarily on Rain and Blood, but even further back, you could say probably on Hell Awaits, or even as you are going to make the argument for, I'm pretty sure, Bakarvich on Haunting the Chapel with Chemical Warfare. I think that's what also makes it stand out so much for Slayer, because even though there's dips in quality, Slayer essentially sounds like Slayer just with differences in speed, except for this record. This one actually sounds like it could be a different band. Like if you cut off Show No Mercy, even Haunting the Chapel EP and Hell Awaits, like, you know, those all still sound like Slayer. This one doesn't. And it's kind of fun in that regard, because you can still, there are still some hallmarks. There's still Kerry King's solo wankery. There's Tom Araya's like signature bark that's still there. And of course, that really cheesy Satanism that is so awesome that they do to perfection in this decade.
Very much so. And, I felt this was a great debut, but as we're going to come to see, the best is yet to come. Some of my favorite tracks of this record would be Metal Storm, Face to Slayer, which is fucking great. The Antichrist.
To talk about Metal Storm, Face to Slayer really quick, I think that it actually is one of the most sort of grandiose and performative tracks in the entirety of Slayer's catalog. They don't really have anything else that is quite as, I'm going to call it episodic, you know, the slash in it certainly signifies that it's kind of two, two mindsets inside a single song, and certainly felt like something that would be played, you know, on a stage in somebody's backyard.
I think that Postmortem and Rain and Blood would be one of the only things, because they kind of do lead into one each other thematically. And then maybe, and I mean maybe, Seasons in the Abyss. But I think you're right. That one does stand head and shoulders as far as like the grandiosity of its songwriting. And that's another really fun thing that Slayer doesn't really ever revisit.
Oh, for certain. It'd be very interesting. The Antichrist, well, which in my opinion, one of the catchiest Slayer songs ever. And Tormentor, the song I mentioned. Yep. And one more thing I want to note about this record is, for a while, this particular album has honestly those memorable solos for Slayer, at least in my opinion, because the middle area, not much there, I hate to say, as far as memorability, though badass as fuck. No denying that.
Before we move on, let's compare their debut artwork to the other big four, Kill 'Em All, Megadeth, Killing Is My Business, the original one with like the shitty claymation.
Yeah. Yes. And
the first Anthrax one.
This full metal.
I can't decide if this is the worst or the best of the big four's debuts. I'm starting to think it's the best, just because of how shitty it is. But it's like fun shitty, as opposed to like wow, you put like no effort into this, like some of the other ones.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
According to my research, with Carrie was talking about, I said a friend of his dad's actually did the painting himself. Apparently Carrie still has the painting in his house. Hmm. Yeah, it was a friend of his dad that did all that. And the way the goat man is positioned, almost like how they position on stage playing. So for being a debut album art, there was quite a bit of thought put into it. So I thought that was quite interesting.
I'm not sure if there's ever, I've never heard anything, so this might just be coming out of my own brain, but that Baphomet goat character is drawn like it could be a mascot, and I wonder if at some point it was meant to be.
Hmm. Like Eddie, considering the Maiden influencer.
Like Eddie, the Merciful Fate, like their demon, Vic Rattlehead from Megadeth, you know, it's not an uncommon thing, and I wonder if it was originally meant for that. Because I kind of took the goat on the front of Rain and Blood to be a callback to that character, but that, like I said, that might just be me.
Yeah, I would say that this one could be the best in my opinion, except for the flames on the type is just kind of what puts it like into sort of cheesetastic territory here. Also, you know, the little devil tail was such a common motif for early, you know, heavy bands like this. It made me, you know, take note of it on the Possessed logo itself, which in some ways kind of could have been modeled after the Show No Mercy type with the flames, you know.
After their fantastic debut of Show No Mercy, the following year, June 1984, they dropped what many consider one of the best thrash EPs of all time, that being Haunting the Chapel, the second release they did for Metal Blade Records. And this truly stepped their game up. This is where the Slayer that we know today really first came to the forefront, with probably one of the best Slayer songs of all time, a live staple, Chemical Fucking Warfare, with the true sense of further aggression, like just evil and darkness that's menacing. And for 84... scared the shit out of a bunch of folks, I'm fucking sure.
Yeah, what was around in 84? Ride the Lightning, I guess it just dropped. Killing Is My Business and Business Is Good had come out, like, what, the year before in 83? I don't know. Had Anthrax dropped their debut? I think they dropped their debut in 80. That around this time, too.
Yeah, 83, yeah. Too. Just full metal, yeah.
Yeah, pretty fucking edgy for the time, I'm sure. I mean, Venom was obviously around, but this was on the cutting edge, satanically speaking, and just sheer speed. It's not quite Rain and Blood levels, but obviously they were starting to push the accelerator down, just testing the limits of what the audience would accept.
I wondered myself, considering how much heavier, you know, this EP really is, and in particular Chemical Warfare, goes to something that's sort of real-minded, talking about the horror of the reactions of, you know, Chemical Warfare, etc. And so there's a lyrical shift going from kind of fantasy to something that's a little bit more horror oriented. And then also just the guitar work and the vocal delivery and everything is a lot heavier. And we've, you know, said edgier. I've wondered myself if this was inside of the band the whole time and they just never thought that it would fly or go over, or if this was actually at this point, you know, Brian Slagle at this point encouraging them to sort of take it to a deeper and darker place.
I mean, the real life horror, as you said, kind of goes in and out of the band. You get it on Chemical Warfare, the song, but that's kind of about it on this record. And then the next record, it kind of disappears entirely. And then they drop possibly the most recognizable Slayer and thrash metal song ever in Angel of Death, which is about, you know, Joseph Meningo, the, you know, Nazi doctor. So they never quite drop their fascination with real world horrors, especially in the 90s with songs like 213,
mm-hmm.
About a lot of serial killers that existed. We'll get into it later as far as which we all prefer, but I think it varies in quality greatly depending on which era of Slayer.
And another thing about this record that I personally feel, and some old heads I found kind of feel this way too, like this could definitely be considered honestly proto-death metal. And like the kind of the shrieks, the intensity, because I looked it up. Possessed Seven Churches came out, I believe it was like June 85. And this was or July 85. This is June 84. So I could definitely see this being an influence on Possessed. Could be wrong. That's just me assuming, but I could definitely see it myself.
If it wasn't for the vocals, yeah. I'm going to say this a lot, but throw Corpse Grinder's vocals on Rain and Blood. That's a death metal record.
100%.
I mean, there's, outside of like the barking, I think is the only thing that really separates it. As far as the heaviness and the speed, I mean, that was straight up death metal and songs.
Even the points. Style of riffing too. I mean, on Chemical Warfare especially, I think I've said it on the air, but as Duald said, the thing that is preventing this from being full on considered death metal, I think, would be Arise vocals. I still feel like this, an argument could be made to say that Chemical Warfare could be the first death metal track. I don't think it's completely outlandish.
In favorite track, Chemical Warfare, honestly. Captor of Sin's really awesome too. And Audi Chapel's not bad, but starts off with a bang and everything else is not as good by comparison. So following this, later in the year that they released in November, Live Undead, which still held in high regard by people that were fans of the band at the time. It was initially supposed to be an actual live record, but something fell through. So there was a radio contest by WBAB Fingers Metal Shop, which is a very famous metal station. That did it from, I believe, 84 to 2016 when that show finally died. But 12 people got the chance to win it, hang out with the band. And so all the gang vocals and shit you hear are of them. So it's all right for a live record, though. I will say the artwork and layout's fantastic. It's done by a guy named Albert Kuehler. It has the band members as zombies and whatnot, like a graveyard. It's really fucking badass. And so their best work, at least in my opinion. But skipping over that to the follow-up, the proper studio follow-up to Show to Mercy 83 would be Hell Awaits in 1985. And to many people, honestly, they consider this the pinnacle of Slayer. And everything after this being utter rubbish, but I personally, those people are insane, but they are entitled to their opinion. According to Carey himself, they were big into Merciful Fate, which is why some of the songs were a bit on the longer side, a bit more tempo changes and whatnot than you hear in an average Slayer song.
I also have ran into a lot of people in my heavy metal fandom that claim this is their best, or this is their favorite Slayer record, maybe if not their best necessarily. And I'm kind of with you, Richard, as I, even after studying it in a way that I never had before for this, you know, segment we're doing right now, I still just don't think it holds up. You know, it's just a little muddy. It's a little long-winded. You know, I think that it's a great stepping stone towards the realization of the band that we have in Rain and Blood and thereafter. But the Merciful Fate thing kind of sounds like, you know, he's trying to ascribe some of the problems with this to being something that could be aspirational. I'm not sure I completely buy it. I think that there's definitely Merciful Fate influence on Show No Mercy. It's not as evident on Hell Awaits. It almost feels like maybe they just hadn't, you know, I don't want to say perfected playing as fast as they needed to in order to arrive at the Rain and Blood ferociousness. That's kind of what it felt like, 'cause there were little glimpses of it here, you know, on tracks like Necrophilia. But on the whole, you know, in terms of the lyrical content as well, it was a lot more of, you know, Satan, hardening of the arteries. I think that the backwards lyrics at the beginning is kind of cheesy and overdone, you know, and you know, a regrettable trope of the genre.
At the time, maybe not so much.
Well, maybe it didn't age very well then. And I'm looking, you know, sort of beating it with the bat of modernity, as you say sometimes, Duel.
Hey, let's give it credit where credit is due. At Dawn They Sleep is on this record.
Yep.
Yes, great track. Kill Again, I find really good. Necrophiliac as well. I like the fact it's, I feel it's one of the shorter songs. It's the most direct, kind of makes sense. Not overly long or long-winded. It just kind of hits you, it gets the hell out of there. So I like that a lot.
And lyrically, I mean, maybe Satanic Cheese, all you want, say what you want about it. Hell Awaits is killer, bro. Killer. Jesus knows his own soul cannot be saved.
Hell Awaits.
Yes, sir.
I would say that there potentially could be seen some early black metal influence on this, with especially how reverbed Uriah's vocals were on this, and then also some of the riffing. I'm going to call out Necrophiliac again.
We've gone down this path, bro. It doesn't end well for us.
I believe it's there, though. The argument is to be made. You can see Dave Lombardo experimenting with the double bass that he, you know, the double bass pedal that he now has. I'd like to call out that part at the end where he hammers it really heavily on At Dawn They Sleep, even though he's yes. not necessarily using it in the way that we will come to see later in their catalog and what is often characterized, where it's really kind of hammering the entire time in a lot of contemporary metal.
Apparently, for Chemical Warfare and Hell Away, Gene Hoglan actually kind of helped them in the studio, literally, because apparently the studio they were in, it was on concrete instead of rug. So Gene was apparently literally holding the drum set as they were recording it. And also he's the one that kind of pushed Dave to do the double bass and stuff, which he perfected on this follow-up record coming up. So that's a kind of cool Dark Angel Slayer connection there.
Speaking of connections, I'm not sure if we've already passed this point in the timeline, but when did Mustaine try to basically end Slayer by pilfering Kerry King? It's about this time, isn't it?
I was going to get to that. Yes, that was about this time. Kerry did quit Slayer very briefly and played about 7 to 8 shows with Megadeth, and two giant egos just don't work. So
I'm going to say I already had a fucking really easy low-hanging fruit dig at Kerry King and his guitar playing ability, and obviously as a rhythm player he's great, it's just his leads that suck. But and I this is a huge but, if you're playing with Megadeth, bro, you can play. You got to give him credit for that. If Dave Mustaine thought you could play, especially if, like, you know what they were playing at the time, Killing Is My Business, and they were about to put out Peace Sells, I mean, Dave obviously thought pretty highly of his guitar playing ability. Or at least thought that, okay, I'll just fucking play all the leads and you can do all the rhythm shit.
No, Dave was being the higher gun, as we know. And
it's too bad that Dave wouldn't have let Kerry King be the vocalist in Megadeth as well, because that would have been a huge upgrade.
Yeah. another thing, a lot of people do credit, though, that Kerry being in Megadeth to that kind of added darkness that Hell Awaits had, even Chemical Warfare. I mean, Haunted of the Chapel brought in too, so there's that connection as well. So, but it was also during the Hell Awaits era that they did the famous Combat the Ultimate Revenge tour with Venom and Exodus, which still talked about the people who attended that tour to this day as one of the best in the history of metal, where it called out the better tracks on the record. And it was during this time, the tour cycle for Hell Awaits, that they came into contact with Rick Rubin from Def Jam Records. And Def Jam was known for more stuff like Run DMC and the Beastie Boys, a hip-hop label. And it was actually, Rick was a fan, but they were signed to Metal Blade, so the other guys were really interested, but it was actually Lombardo that reached out to Rick about saying, you know, what contract he had to offer the band. So Rick went to see them at the Ritz, which was a club in New York City, and was blown away by them. So he tried to get them to come on at first. The band said, no, we're with Brian Slagle, Metal Blade. But once they kind of realized, you know, the increased exposure and money and push they could get as the band, eventually Aaron came along with Dave to agree to go with Def Jam and go to the studio and record possibly the pinnacle of thrash metal, the thrash metal Bible that many call it, which would be Rain in Blood from 1986.
I will say this regarding the thrash metal Bible. So the only other thrash albums that most people throw out to combat Rain in Blood supremacy is Metallica's Master of Puppets or Megadeth's Rest in Peace.
Yes. And
while I am the Rust in Peace stan of the group, and that's my pick, none of those other two albums, and I'm referring to Master of Puppets and Rust in Peace, spawned an entire genre of worship music the way Rain and Blood did. Rain and Blood, to this day, spawns dozens of Slayer, essentially Rain and Blood worship every year, with very little differences. And what was that, 35 years ago? Close to it? That would just be my take on that.
One of the greatest metal records of all time, top 10 easily. I mean, it's one of those records so great, and a lot of records, especially me being the elitist I am here with all these records, you know, these all great, fantastic, and nothing ever lives up to it. This is one of the ones that way exceeded my expectations, and it's goddamn perfect, man.
Before you joined,
the first time I heard it.
Yeah, before you joined as a host, Richard, Duel and I had done top 10 American heavy metal records, and this was certainly, I think, in the top five for both of us. Is that right, Duel? I'll need to go back and look at my list, but
I want to say it's in both of our top threes.
Yeah. So its significance should not be overlooked here. And also, what a huge leap forward it is compared to Hell Awaits. I remember even just listening to them back-to-back in preparation for this segment, I slacked and said, holy shit. You know, I think my first note that I have here is, holy shit, this is next level. Everything is 1,000 times faster. It's 1,000 times sharper. You know, Rick was able to just transform Tom Araya's vocals from something that at times came off as a little whiny potentially to, you know, something that's pretty ferocious, I think. You know, that falsetto in Angel of Death is an all-time, you know, high moment in the genre.
He channels the inner mania that exists with Tom Araya, that even after this record that Rick Rubin just kind of, I don't know, told him how to get there, because this exists on other records after this one, but this is the first one where Tom Araya kind of sounds like a psycho sometimes. Like, he really gets into character, and it's awesome. Like, on things like Criminally Insane or
Jesus Piece by Saves. Piece.
Yeah, Piece by Piece. Real good. Give a lot of credit to Tom Araya on this record. And, like, I really like Tom's vocals in this decade, but he's rarely the best part. It's usually the music, but I think you could say his vocal performances on more than a few of these songs might be, like, part of the reason they are so, as you say, so goddamn ferocious.
I think it's really interesting, and I have a note here speculating that potentially Rubin's focus on vocals came from his experience working with hip-hop artists, you know, in metal. It hadn't always necessarily been considered a focus of that. And so he was able to, I guess, give it that extra bit of attention that kind of took it across the finish line, you know, and really made this so much better.
Oh, for sure. The, you know, one of the big main things record that you brought up, everybody says, is the massive speed, like for the minus a few parts here, there's song. It just all guns a ho all the time. And that's a thing they were wanted to do on the tour for, you know, Hell Awaits and playing those kind of more slower plotting songs. They wanted to be fast hell, as well as the fact that Hodiman was very influenced by Minor Threat, Black Flag, all that hardcore punk stuff, super fast. He liked the energy, but he just liked the simplicity of it. So it was apparently, it was very easy to get Tom and Dave aboard, especially his drumming took a big step up this record. It was really Kerry King was like the last holdout to kind of that fast short, which sounds very Kerry like when you think about it. But Democracy One, we have one of the finest metal albums of all time. And it was actually during this era where, for the first time, Dave actually left the band midway through the tour for Rain and Blood, because he was the one that got them, made the connection with Rubin to get them signed to label, and just come home from tour. And he's fucking broke. He can't pay his bills. He can't afford food. So he was essentially just burnt out. This bullshit, I'm done. So Dave left the band after being burnt out money-wise. He
honestly, for this segment, I mean, it's almost like if you're listening to this, then you've heard Rain and Blood. We can sit here and wax about the finer points of it all day long, but in many ways, it's probably the one we could gloss over.
Well, the precursor. We talked about this in the pregame, this isn't on air, about how there's the satanic lyrics of the 80s and there's the more real world, just straight up anti-religious stuff that's more in your face, like, fuck you. And in a way, you kind of get that, but I think it's the best of both worlds with Jesus Saves on this record. Snarky, definitely has a point of view.
Yeah.
But it's not quite the fuck you and the horse you rode in on style lyrics that you get on God Hates Us All and Christ Delusion.
No, not really. I mean, this also, I can't gloss over this. You know, the song Angel of Death, the opening song on this record, hugely controversial at the time. I mean, they're accused of being Nazis and whatnot. You know, accused say they're glorifying what went on in Germany in 41 to 45.
I think we all know the Nazis.
Yeah.
It was before 41. It was back in the early 30s, too.
Popular thing, but yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
I guess that's something we should talk about. Is that something that bothers y'all at all? For me, it's not so much. I mean, honestly, like, and they kind of flirted with it kind of hard with the Slatanic Wehrmacht too, with their mascot wearing a World War II soldier's helmet. You know, they weren't exactly being shy about it, especially the word Wehrmacht. So what do y'all think about that? Does it bother you at all? Was it just 80s edge? Because this was also the time when, you know, it wasn't too many years before that Sid Vicious was wearing a straight up, like, you know, red Nazi shirt. Let Me Kill Mister obviously collected Nazi memorabilia. The dudes in Metallica were seen photographing with the Sieg Heil. So, I mean,
Rob Flynn as well.
Nazi associations, I think, I don't know if they were just way more prevalent in the 1980s. The more Repub among us would say that we weren't snowflakes back then, but it's obviously got to be a much deeper thing. I'm just curious to get both of your thoughts on it and whether or not it bothers you. Like, would you have any qualms about wearing the Golden Slayer Eagle t-shirt?
Yes, I would not wear that shirt. It never bothered me and me actually believing that they were Nazis for a single second. I mean, they're a multiracial band, and so it would be very hard for me to come along with the idea that that's actually something that they condoned. And, you know, and I think part of it too, it's, there are so many other extreme things that I've seen in metal. This one, I think, you know, this day and age doesn't necessarily jump out at me. I think you made a great point as well, Duel, you know, talking about Sid Vicious, using Nazism to be controversial is kind of the same way that many people, especially in black metal, use Satan. You know, it's just counterculture. Like, they're doing it, you know, as a way to evoke, you know, anger. So no, I wouldn't wear the shirt, you know, being a person whose ancestors descended from the Caucasus Mountains, as they say, meaning I'm white. But I, you know, and I also wonder too.
You're doing a metal podcast, sir. We got that.
Yeah. no, I wonder, with the Nazism charges, had Carrie shaved his head at this point? Because, I mean, Hanneman with his long blonde hair and Carrie with the, you know, donning the Nazi eagle, that could have been a bad look.
Even on Seasons in the Abyss, Carrie's wearing a flat bill with long hair past his chest. Like, I don't think Carrie cuts his hair for the 90s.
It wasn't until Divine Intervention around that era when he went all baldy.
Okay. Well, disregard that speculation then. You know, considering, again, mixed racial band, there's only one, you know, blonde guy in there. I wouldn't wear the merch because I think that, you know, it would draw unwanted attention to myself, even though I like the t-shirt, you know.
Honestly, in the live show, every time I see them, when the Golden Eagle drops and they set that shit on fire, goosebumps. Shit's killer. Although, I would wear the shirt. However, I would understand if people threw me side eyes, just because obviously people aren't probably going to look at the logo and be like, Slayer. They're just going to see the eagle.
I think Slayer is known enough in the ether of popular culture now that, as, you know, controversial, that, you know, maybe these days, you know, maybe those two things would stand side to side, or maybe this is part of the reason that it's conflated to be such. Because, again, you know, I think that most people would probably know that Slayer is a heavy band. The amount of people that I've heard who are not metal fans call Slayer a death metal band has been, you know, numerous. You know, and I would have to say, like, not really, but I understand what you're saying. Like, you know, I get it. I think this is probably one of the reasons why, because, again, this, you know, they had so much success in this with this record too. I mean, as much as they'd ever had at that point, and it's obviously its legacy has gone on to proliferate throughout many a subgenre.
Oh, for certain. To be honest, I don't think there's anything to it. Would I wear the shirt? Not really. Not because I was wearing side eyes. I just have no interest in wearing the shirt, to be honest. So, but a couple
unless,
of.
Unless you're willing to pay out the ass for vintage t-shirts, that the Eagle t-shirt is one of the only good Slayer designs that exists, IMO. For some reason, like, the Big Four merch sucks. Like, unless you want to pay like $300 for like 80s and 90s vintage tour designs.
I don't know, dude. I like the Metallica Pusshead shirts. Those ones, they have some pretty good ones. I've worn a number of those in my day.
Pusshead, I'm familiar with that Metallica mascot.
Well, Pusshead is the artist who does all of that, like the jagged skulls.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Oh, shit, ain't too bad. It's all right. couple of all these songs would be standout songs, but the obvious ones are Angel of Death, which we just discussed, Raining Blood, post-war Raining Blood, honestly, because it could be the same song. It's a fucking fantastic transition. Criminally Insane, a personal favorite of mine.
Yeah, sick. Altar of Sacrifice, not to be overlooked.
Altar of Sacrifice, Piece
Reborn
by Piece.
Is a personal favorite of mine. It's like about as fast. Like, I mean, we're just going to name every fucking song on the
album. Yeah.
Fucking record, dude, because I was also going to throw out Jesus Saves.
Jesus Saves.
There's no song on this record that is not fantastic. I was being totally serious when I said if your top 10 was Rain and Blood, the end, and you just rearranged which ones were your favorite, that's a totally legit list.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the touring for this record, they toured with Overkill from October to December in the States, as well as a band called Malice in Europe from April to May 87. And they also did a big tour with Wasp. And I am a big Wasp fan, but I'm not going to lie. But apparently, Black was utter cocksucker to the guys. Like, he wouldn't give like lights during their set, like air conditioning, smoke machines. The dude was a raging cocksucker. But it was during this tour that Dave left the band for the first time. His reason being that he helped the band get the connection to Rick to get this big label deal, and yet he still broke as hell after every tour and having trouble paying his utility bills, hell, feeding himself. So he steps out of the band midway through all the touring for this album. And so to replace him, they got the man by the name of Tony Scaglione of Jersey cult thrash heroes Whiplash to fill in. So once the touring was done for this record, they started doing auditions and whatnot. And actually future Megadeth alum Nick Menza actually almost got the position. He was very, very fucking close to getting it. But then Rick would not keep calling Dave. He was like, Dave, we need you back at the band. Dave, we need you back at the band. Dave, we need you back at the band. So Dave came to the auditions, tried out again for the band, and he was back in the band again. So,
thanks, Ruben. Thank you.
Yeah. So going from this point, obviously, this record being incredibly fucking fast, in the words of Hahnemann, we knew we couldn't top Rain and Blood, so we had to slow down. We knew whatever we did, it was going to be compared to that record. And I remember actually discussing slowing it down. It was weird. We had never done that on an album before or since. And Carrie had kind of shared the same sentiment in other interviews I could find as well. And this record being 1988's South of Heaven, which say very much a 180 by comparison to the speed of Rain. But in my opinion, some of their most evil, creepy, and excellent fucking songs in their entire catalog. And it's, in my opinion, a very possibly most underrated Slayer record ever.
I'm going to jump in here and ask two questions. I kind of want to call BS on them saying that they were never going to be able to top it, because I think back to Phil Anselmo discussing how him and Dime had personally wondered how they were going to top A Vulgar Display of Power, and ultimately came out with Far Beyond Driven, which was a much heavier record. And so I thought to myself in listening
and
to this,
better, I think we can all agree they did end up topping that record.
What if they had tried? You know, like what if they gave that another effort? Like, you know, and they got solidarity from Rick and they said, we're just going to keep pushing, like, and see what the hell. That sounds like a record that I personally would want to hear. I don't know about y'all, but.
Two things. One, very interesting. But secondly, had they done that, would they have ever slowed down? Or would they have settled into a niche at that point?
I'm not even sure that would have been.
What if Slayer just turned into their own Slayer worship band? I think the death metal fucking comparisons would have been more apt, or maybe it would be much more accepted at this point if they had continued with that. Because obviously, if they put out another super fast ass record in 1988, I think that's when South of Heaven was released. That was right the time that death metal was starting to happen. So.
Second thing that I wanted to say is that people always talk about the slowness of this record, but really, you know, it starts out, you know, the title track certainly is a little bit slower than what was exhibited on Rain and Blood. But overall, there's a lot of really fast fucking tracks on this. I mean, I think about Silent Scream and Ghosts of War, to name two, are at Rain and Blood tempo, you know, certainly. And, you know, Behind the Crooked Cross is not far behind either. So I think it's a mischaracterization that South of Heaven is this, you know, sort of, you know, drippy, sludgy album that it's sometimes, you know, characterized as.
It's a mid-tempo record. I wouldn't say there's anything slow on it.
Like, yeah.
For real.
I wouldn't even characterize it as being slow. It's pretty fast. It's just by comparison, you know.
Well, from what I could find, another reason why was the fact that Rain and Blood, also the fact it was so fast, that there was a lot of solid like breaks and stuff, and it kind of morbid tempo. So that's one motivation too, to kind of, I guess, make the live performance endurance a little better. Have some slower songs, kind of regain the energy for the faster ones as well.
Richard, are you speculating, or do you have any quotes or information on them? Because I mean, it makes good sense, you know. I mean,
that's an interview from Carey.
Yeah.
From Carey saying that, like, everything was so fast for Rain Blood, they, you know, they wanted some more mid tempo stuff to kind of give the set some more variety and also, you know, give them a little rest time as well. So,
in regards to the tempo of Rain and Blood, I've always read multiple quotes from people who recalled listening to it for the first time and comparing it to seeing a train come so close to going off the rails, but never quite doing it. It reminded me of a band playing live that can't actually play that fast, but they pulled it off at that time. Like that sort of, like, that could have been total chaos, but it just ended up being like pure bottled energy just shot out to the listening public. And I'm not sure that's something you could recapture again, because maybe they were playing that record totally comfortably. Maybe not. I get the vibe they're really pushing themselves to the limit. But after a while, once you've pushed yourself to that limit, the next record might not ever have that same feeling because you're more comfortable playing at that speed. I'm not sure that Rain and Blood could ever be topped, is what I'm saying. That lightning, I'm not sure, could ever be recaptured again.
Yeah, very possibly. Some notes I have here is apparently going to this record, they didn't really have a lot of songs lyrically written. So Tom was able to kind of flex his writing muscles. So he penned all of lyrically South of Heaven, Cleanse the Soul, Mandatory Suicide, Silent Scream, which is actually a song about abortion, which I kind of figured about going in. It's actually a song about abortion. And he also co-wrote the track Read Between the Lies as well. And as well on this record, Tom's vocals aren't really screamed. They're more just kind of sung, not like great singing, but, you know, competent enough singing, the job done. But and a lot of the reason why it was like this was because Carey was at the time married, so he was in his total literal honeymoon phase, so he was not really in the studio a lot. So it was Tom and Jeff essentially made most of the big decision for this record, why it sounds so different and why this is one of Carey's least favorite albums. Probably why it's one of the better ones as well.
We won't find out on this episode, but you'll see what happens when you leave Carey to his own devices later.
Some favorite tracks off this record. Obviously, the title track is a Keep Alive staple and one of the best Slayer songs ever. Behind the Crooked Cross, to me, is a personal favorite of mine, has always been. And Mandatory Suicide, I mean, fuck, dude, one of the best. Ghost of War.
It's all about Ghost of War on this record. Ghost of War and South of Heaven are like a cut above, I think. I do like some Mandatory Suicide. I think that is really cool. Read Between the Lies, which was also previously mentioned, is another great one. But I think that Ghost of War and South of Heaven are a cut above everything else on this record.
So
and really, really influenced my maybe outsized appreciation for it.
Yeah, I want to shout out Silent Scream, which is actually an educational video that was released during the 80s, which kind of started the anti-abortion movement or, you know, craze here in the United States, which is about to be realized when Roe is overturned in a couple months. But it was a song that I had early attention towards because Children of Bodom played a great cover of it. And I've often said maybe one of the instances where, you know, the cover supersedes the original, but the version. Slayer's version, obviously, is a personal favorite of mine. And I also want to shout out Live Undead as well, just as kind of a fun one. So another instance where I think that we've called out nearly every track on the record.
You mentioned a cover. Did y'all ever hear, and I know, don't cringe when I say their name, did you ever listen to Hatebreed's cover of Ghosts of War?
No.
Greatest thing Hatebreed's ever recorded.
I believe I have. I thought it was all right. Actually, it wasn't terrible. I actually remember I saw Hatebreed live once with Typo Negative, 3 inches of Blood. And the best part of Hatebreed's set was they played an intro to Raining Blood.
I walked out on Hatebreed 3 times. Does that kind of see in them once?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
I saw Kingdom of Sorrow. That was cool.
I saw Hatebreed at Ozfest. You know, I sat through that set. It was energetic. They did their job.
Emphasis on sit.
So for the touring for South, they support Judas Priest on the Ram It Down tour, which is a nice return to form to them from the much maligned Turbo, and rightfully so, as well as touring Europe with Nuclear Assault, which that was a hell of a show. Nuclear Assault and Slayer on the same bill.
Wow.
And another U.S. tour with Slayer co-headlining with Motorhead and Overkill opening up, which I bet would have been sick as fuck as well.
God, so doesn't Life as a Metalhead in the 80s sound fucking fantastic? You just, you know, we repeat these tours and I'm like, my mouth is salivating here. See, Nuclear
Timothy
Assault.
Timothy says it all the time. It was like, there's a thing as born too late. And he was like, Metal Son, you were born way too fucking late.
Yeah.
There's actually a website I found in doing this. I found through the wiki page, and it's this massive, like old school, like 98 HTML website. It has all the dates, flyers, pictures from every era, at least up to like the mid 90s. That's fucking incredible. Some of the shows, dude, it's like, Jesus Christ. Oh man. Goosebumps thinking about it. But,
like Timothy is one of the people that got one of those 100 later, the Golden Eagle Slater pins that says later for their, that they only gave away to their close friends and family. Mm. And oh, wow. Yeah, Timothy is one of the 100 people who got one. So
that's fucking awesome. Holy shit.
But he was talking about seeing them, like seeing Slayer for the first time in like 84 and seeing them, like, you know, as they evolved. And that might be one of the things I'm most jealous about outside of seeing, early Megadeth too. Getting to see, like, I'm glad I got to see the original Slayer lineup twice, but I realized seeing that lineup in 2009 and then 2000 and whenever the fuck the other two times I saw them is not the same as seeing them in 1986.
Oh no, dude! I believe it was on the Get Thrashed DVD. John and Marshall Cezular talk about seeing Slayer at, I think it was L'Amour's on the South of Heaven tour. Said the most intense fucking show he had ever seen. I was like, he's like, even if the devil was there, he was fucking shitting his britches too. Like, it just, it shows a video of the crowd, just the whole crowd just losing their goddamn minds. And just Dave talks about, and they're touring in this era, just blood after show just drips in the piles of it everywhere. It's different era, man.
I mean, that it's just the element of danger, and I never grew up in an era where metal has ever been considered dangerous. Even death and black metal shows, I've never been like in danger, whereas even thrash metal shows in the 80s, let alone the early death metal shows and the black metal shows in the 90s, like, people just got fucked up all the time, like physically. Maybe it's a good thing that people don't get physically assaulted when they just want to go to be entertained these days, but the danger element is definitely something that's not there anymore.
No, not at all. Maybe a good thing, as you said. But going onwards, after all the touring and stuff went down, the Carriers, you know, wanted to bring back more of the more aggressive style of vocals, kind of that were on Rain and Blood. So they went in the studio and they came out with 1990s Seasons in the Abyss, which was a combination of Rain and South. And to a lot of people, this is their favorite Slayer record. It's perfectly fine, but I feel, you know, it has lesser effect, to my humble opinion, at least. Though I will say I like the catchiness of the solos, the memorability, which was necessary there so much on certain Rain and Blood and South of Heaven tracks. And I do appreciate the thicker production as well on Seasons as well. I think if you step up, you know, I do love South of Heaven. Now, what are y'all's thoughts on this last of the classic era of the Almighty Slayer?
It starts off incredibly with War Ensemble, one of their best songs. I also think it features their Jumping the Shark moment. Self-references in one of my favorite songs of the record, one of my favorite Slayer songs of all time, Spirit in Black. Once you start name-dropping Rain and Blood and South of Heaven and
Hell Awaits.
Yeah, and Hell Awaits all in your same song. It's like, okay, you're calling out your own hits here. What comes next? And obviously, in hindsight now, in 2022, we know what comes next, and this was the Jumping the Shark moment for Slayer. But that song fucking rules, and this album really fucking rules. It never reaches the high water marks that Rain and Blood does, but really nothing ever does after Rain and Blood. But Spirit in Black is really cool. War Ensemble is really cool. And Dead Skin Mask is one of their crowning achievements, especially considering just how slowed down it is for Slayer, one of their slowest songs ever, but it works.
I think that there's a tonal shift in pretty much all of the lyrics away from, there's very little Satan featured. You know, I think, I can't remember if it was on the air earlier or it was off the air. We talked about Born in Fire really being kind of the only instance where they were talking about sort of fantasy Satan. This is actually overall kind of a war themed record, as well as having some pretty interesting social criticisms just about like gun violence and expendable youth, as well as Hallowed Point, which I think is personally a fantastic track on this record. I also wanted to point out that they kind of get political.
Who knew Slayer's out here still relevant in 2022 with songs like Expendable Youth. Holy shit.
Yeah, there's political criticism in Blood Red. He says, you cannot hide the face of death, oppression ruled by bloodshed. No disguise can deface evil. Stains the primitive sickle blood red. So he's clearly criticizing communist governments. I don't say clearly, but to me that's a plain allusion to, you know, the primitive sickle. Which is, you know, interesting and certainly not something that I ever got into. There wasn't a real sense of or feeling of criticism of Joseph Mengele on Angel of Death. But they're actually that's a lie. I'm not going to say it's the first time, because Behind the Crooked Cross is about a Nazi soldier, you know, questioning whether or not what they are doing is correct. And yes. So it's there. But I think that we saw the inklings of it. Sort of the beginnings of it on South of Heaven, and it actually sort of overtakes what was previously the lyrical theme of fantasy Satan for the earliest records for Slayer. So I really like this record for that reason alone. I also like how it does sort of shift the tempo back up a little bit. I do think that overall this is a faster and sort of sharper record. I think that the guitars sound better, where I will say on South of Heaven at times the guitars sounded a little tinny, and I think about that clean passage at the end on Spill the Blood, like that clean tone was just so lifeless in my opinion. They seem to just have made it a little better. I think this is one of the first times where sort of down tuning is featured as well in Slayer, which is going to be something that is featured, you know, a lot more prominently pretty much going forward, and we'll get into it Slayer Part 2. But I'm pretty sure that they were at least in D on most of these, whereas previously I think that they played a lot of their stuff in just sort of a half step down or in standard tuning.
I think the easiest way to describe this record or catalog it is the combination of Rain and South of Heaven, just because you do get the fast stuff and you do get the mid-tempo stuff, and they are in pretty equal measure throughout the entirety of the record. It starts off balls to the wall with War Ensemble and ends with a much more South of Heaven stylistically leaning track in Seasons in the Abyss, with lots of kind of go between and in the middle there.
Yeah, I'd say that's a very good description of this record. You kind of called out all the songs I really like, though you're not partial. That me and Pete are both very partial to A Skeletons of Society, which is a personal favorite Slayer song of mine. It, to me personally, it reminded me of that old, I believe it's Hanna-Barbera show, Thundar the Barbarian. It's basically this post-apocalyptic world, this like He-Man like character with a laser sword, like a sorceress, and like this Chewbacca like thing. But later, for some reason, when I first heard the song, it reminded me of that.
That makes well me like it less. That characterization of that song that you just did, Richard, makes me like that song less. But
I'm sorry, but that's what always reminded me of. That's I was this more mature version. But also the I remember several times growing up being in high school, listen to this record, and I'd fall asleep, a Dead Skin Mask would be on, and then they're all like, Mr. Gaines, can you lay out Mr. Gaines? Like wake up a Dead Skin, what the fuck? Okay.
One of the rare uses of samples. It's really not something that Slayer does very much. I think back to, you know, the rain sounds at the end of Raining Blood, but it's really not something that they do very much of at all.
Also, it's one of the only times that creepy child samples don't come off as just totally fucking like campy. Like
I'd fight you on that one. I think it comes off pretty bad.
I think it works. I mean, but the first time, you just kind of numb to it. The first time, that's I guess, it's pretty, gets the job, gets the point across. But multiple lists is the kind of the effects lesson.
And it was also in 1990. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any way to do it without having a few eyebrow raises. Like, what the fuck? It's not even fucking creepy, dude. It's just lame. But it was 1990. Whereas, like, on I Loved You at Your Darkest, the most recently release Behemoth record, when you have those child samples that come in, it's just like this again, like cue the Robert Downey Jr. meme of the eye roll. Like, that's how I feel every time I hear it now, but it's just as prevalent now. Like people for some reason think it works. It doesn't stop it. Yeah. Children saying things that are satanic or murderous isn't creepy. It's just cheesy.
Now, we see a little bit of flirtations with some of the early progressiveness of the band. So I think about the title track. You get that big gong hit early. I mean, you know, I think back to Rain and Blood, and I was like, there was no place a gong would have ever been appropriate on that record, and yet it works here. So that's kind of fun.
Oh, yes, sure. Actually, that song was a pretty big hit for the band, as well as Warren Song, which was the first video, proper video, the band had ever done. I think we'd all agree it's Season Mist is a pretty great video as far as 80s videos go, or it's like technically 90, but great fucking video. At least I would say so myself. I mean, Egypt and whatnot, really a lot of cool imagery and whatnot in that. But as far as tours for this record, they did a headliner with Testament in 91, which would have fucking sick. Practice What You Preach era, Testament and Slayer Sees the Abyss.
Clash of the Titans was not long after this, too.
I was about to say, yeah. There's Clash of Titans, which was first in Europe, which was them, Megadeth, Testament, and Suicidal Tendencies. And then they brought that over to America.
With Pantera and fucking Alice in Chains?
Yeah, that was Clash of the Titans.
Megadeth. But it was Pantera, it was Megadeth, Anthrax,
and Alice in Chains.
And it was supposed to be Death Angel originally, but then they had that bad van crash end of that band for the time being. And then Alice in Chains was the opening band, which was a sign of things to come and musical climate change, which was right on the horizon.
Am I wrong? Did Pantera not play on that Clash of the Titans tour?
Pantera opened for Judas Priest in like this era. I know that when we, you know, talked about
those Cowboys from Hell, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, it has to have been because they were touring with them on they were touring for Painkiller right before Rob left the band to go do his very Pantera sounding solo projects. Right. So yeah,
but it was okay. And it was during the touring for this record that
Suicidal Tendencies. Sorry.
It was also during this time as well that Dave was having a theme that'll come up again, issues with money, about him not feeling like he's getting paid enough, and as well as, Kerry took time off during South to, be with his wife, and then this kind of thing of the event to come, but during Divine Intervention, Jeff took time because he kind of married his high school sweetheart, and Dave wanted time off for his second child being born, but they kept adding more dates and more dates and more dates till finally Dave just was forced to leave the band. And
if you listen to Tom Araya, that happened again. which goes back to the more things change, the more they stay the same, considering Dave Lombardo's financial situation with Slayer that we're still dealing with to this day. And then how Tom Araya wanted to be done with Slayer way earlier than supposedly they were. This is a lot of hearsay. I'm not sure how much of this is actually corroborated by the band, but supposedly Slayer should have ended earlier, but the farewell tour just kept getting extended and extended and extended and extended.
I believe it was 5 farewell tours, if I remember correctly. It was at least 4. I'm pretty sure it was 5.
I saw them, I think, on like the second to last farewell tour that they did in Atlanta. Because I was like, this is the last time. And then they announced another tour, and I could have seen them again. I was like, that was good. I'm good.
Kind of pulled an Ozzy. There was like No More Tears. It was supposed to be his final tour, quote unquote. It just kind of kept that shit going to oblivion. So, but so Dave's out of the band, and they put the call out, and Paul Bostoff, who had freshly left Forbidden, they did a jam session with them. They gave him 9 songs to learn in like a day's time. He messed up 2 of them by accounts by Tom, and he joined the band. And this is where we are going to stop for part 1. Next, we are going to do our honorable mentions and top 10 lists. So whoever would like to go first can go right ahead.
All right, so I have 2 honorable mentions. Typically, I only do 1, but Richard, you see, you had 2. So I'm going to honorable mention Tormentor off of Show No Mercy, and I'm also going to honorable mention Altar of Sacrifice off of Rain and Blood. Both fantastic tracks. Altar of Sacrifice is maybe my most listened to song, but off of Rain and Blood, certainly a personal favorite Slayer track, but lyrically, there's not a lot of meat there. It's kind of just more of the same shit with a lot of fun riffs, so... that's why I didn't make the cut. So coming in at number 10, I have Necrophiliac off of Hell Awaits. I
clearly never learned the strength of the words of Praise Hail Satan.
Satan, Satan, Satan. So Necrophiliac off of Hell Awaits. I talked about how I think this could be viewed as certainly proto black metal, and I think it's probably my favorite track off of Hell Awaits as well. Coming in at number 9, I have Skeletons of Society off of Seasons of the Abyss. I think at least in this segment of it, it's probably the most realized mid-tempo track that they have. They've got some great solos in there, and I also like the post-apocalyptic theme, which once again could be viewed as genuine social criticism from that era of Slayer. Coming in at number 8, I have Raining Blood, the famous track off of the almost eponymously named Rain in Blood. This is probably Slayer's most famous song. Maybe one other, you know, Angel of Death could be slotted in there, but I've certainly spent many an hour practicing this one with various bands that I've played, and I certainly love all of the riffs. When I was reading the lyrics, it's kind of interesting, but I think that, you know, for me, it could potentially be seen as a perspective of a miscarried child. You know, it's kind of poetic, but when they say trapped in the purgatory, you know, raining from the sky, there could be some allusions to that. I've never seen anybody talk about that before, but it was just something that I thought of myself when I was going back over it. Part of the reason why I don't think it's slotted higher again is because there isn't a lot of lyrical meat there for me. Coming in at number seven, I have Postmortem, the track that leads into Raining Blood, and personally another one of my all-time favorite Slayer tracks. I think it's my all-time favorite Tom Araya's falsetto when he says fatality reality, I await the final and screams it out. And it's just, you know, the amount of people who know Raining Blood, but they sort of have never really sat down and, or I would say young metal fans have never sat down and listened to Raining Blood in its entirety. And I say, no, there's this whole really almost poppy part that comes before Raining Blood that really makes the impact of it, you know, that much greater in my opinion, which is why I think it slots higher for me.
The lyrics at the very end, when it gets super, super fast, is actually one of my favorite parts on the whole record.
Yeah. All right, coming in at number 7.
I am what I want, I'm only after death. Do you want to die?
Coming in at number 6, I have Behind the Crooked Cross off of South of Heaven. So this is one of the first times that we take a look at, I don't know, introspective lyrics, I guess, from Slayer. So it's about viewed as a Nazi soldier questioning the merits of what it is that they are doing. And that's what the Crooked Cross allusion is to, is the swastika. Whereas I think before studying it, I had always thought that Crooked Cross was probably just another sort of cavalier jest at the church being the crucifix, but the cross itself is not. It's more Nazi imagery. I wish
I'm assuming they refer to the Iron Cross.
Yeah. Oh, is that what that is? Iron Cross. I guess that makes sense too. I wish that this song was just like a little sharper. Like it just, I think the riffs are cool, but I think production maybe hampers it slightly. I always thought that it sounded just a tad muddy, but that's just a nitpick for myself. Getting to the top five now, I have Silent Scream from South of Heaven. I talked about the reasons why I like this one. It's fast as hell. It's memorable riffing. It's about, you know, abortion, named after the video that really started the anti-abortion movement in this country. I fucking love it, and so did Alexi Laiho. Coming in at number four, I have Reborn off of Rain and Blood. This is kind of a standout in their catalog because it's the only song that I can find that is actually from a woman's perspective, a woman, a witch who is about to be burned at the stake. Which I think is pretty interesting. And I will say that this is probably about as fast as Slayer ever gets, both in BPMs and also how many words Tom actually jams into this song is just still impressive. Coming in at number three, this is going to be the controversial pick, I can tell, but I've hollowed Point off of Seasons of the Abyss. This song, this song is so great because it's about gun violence, and he actually references the title track sort of in jest. I'm going to go back and read the lyric here, but he says, snap the tongue and groove discharge to make my hollowed point. It could be seen as basically somebody describing what it's like to execute a person at point blank with a bullet. It's actually pretty graphic and pretty gory, and I really like the riffing. I like the end parts. I think it has great leads on it. I think it's overlooked. Coming in at number two, I have Angel of Death. I think that this one could be an obvious sort of top of the order pick here, but it's one of the first times that they ever get really controversial with the, you know, Nazism, and the riffs are fantastic. The falsetto, it's near perfection. And coming in at number one for me is Chemical Warfare off of Haunting the Chapel, just because of its influence, you know, my personal love for the track as well. And just how grim and dark it is, that even to this day, after all the other heavy things that we around, I still kind of get goosebumps when I listen to it. So,
okay. So my honorable mentions, and I know I'm apparently known, which I found out, for having more honorable mentions than everybody else. So I guess I'll stick with that theme. Tormentor and the Antichrist from Show No Mercy are on my honorable mentions list, as is Hell Awaits from Hell Awaits. I will also throw in Postmortem from Rain and Blood. I will also throw in Behind the Crooked Cross as well on my honorable mentions. That'll complete it. Let me go ahead and get into my top 10 just for time's sake. Coming in at number 10, I have At Dawn They Sleep. I think it's the only vampire song Slayer's ever written, but if they could write them all at this quality, they should have tried again, let me tell you. Number 9, Bogorvich's, one of his favorite songs, although I figured it would rank higher in his list, Chemical Warfare. Dead Skin Mask coming in at number 8. I also have South of Heaven from South of Heaven, obviously, coming in at number 7. At number 6, maybe a little high, but if you had told me I was going to put it at number 6 before this episode, I might have thought it was a little high, but Ghosts of War, also from South of Heaven, comes in. And then it's about to get like Rain and Blood Worship here. Number 5, War Ensemble for Seasons in the Abyss, you might not expect. And then number 4, Spirit in Black, also from Seasons in the Abyss. One of my favorite Slayer songs. It might be the jumping the shark moment, but that shark jump was fucking cool. Let me fucking tell you. You're
goddamn right.
Like, they might be name checking their own songs and their own hits, but there's a reason they're doing it, and it hits. You know, every time I hear them play it live, it hits me in the soul. And then coming in at number 3, it's Jesus Saves from Rain of Blood. Just listen to it if you haven't. I know you have. I'm sure the hook is going through your mind right now as you hear it. Number 2 is Altar of Sacrifice. I was a little disappointed that it only made Boggs honorable mentions, but I think it's one of the quintessential Slayer songs.
I love
and
it.
Then at number 1.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to butt in there. I did have to say, like, I do fucking love that song, but, you know, I have to weigh the criteria against something. There had been so much Satan in their catalog up to that point. It was hard for me to try and, you know, really put it on high.
But that was like the Satan song.
The Satan song. The Satan song.
They packed so much Satan in like 2 minutes and 9 seconds compared to like, what, 6 minutes for Hell Awaits? Like, the efficiency, you got to give them credit for it. And then coming in at number 1, it's no fucking surprise, it's Angel of Death. I mean, what the fuck? Do you even listen to Slayer? Richard Donahue, your turn.
Fucking poser. All right. So for my honorable mentions, I have the Antichrist, which, as I mentioned, one of the catchiest Slayer songs. And I much love this version. I think Dissection did a little better on the EP before Storm the Lights Bang. So definitely check that shit out.
I love a call out, brother. Fuck yeah. Yeah.
As well as Live Undead.
Hey, or, just to drop a seed, not to interrupt, but just to drop a seed. This won't be the last time that someone else covers a Slayer song and they do it better than Slayer. And I'll leave it at that. Tease.
Live Undead, which I was, when in the research, they made a good point. You know, there's the Live Undead, or is it Live Undead? Is that really explained? But either way, I think it's a really underrated, really, really great Slayer song. Off South of Heaven, though I agree with Pete, the production of the record isn't necessarily the best.
I'm pretty sure he straight up says the Live Undead. I'm pretty sure it's Live Undead. Yeah.
Coming at number 10, I have a Skeletons of Society, one of my very underrated Slayer tracks, one that I enjoy a lot. Though the reasons why are a bit goofy, I'm not going to lie, but just really good stuff, great atmosphere to it, and tells a really good story, which a lot of Slayer songs don't to me, but this is one that really does it very effectively, I'd say. Coming in at number 9, I have Behind the Crooked Cross, always been a personal favorite of mine, off of South of Heaven. Number 8, Dead Skin Mask, off of Seasons in the Abyss. Number 7, Ghosts of War, from South of Heaven. Number 6, this song, when I first heard this record, was one that stuck out and still enjoy to this day, is Spirit in Black of Season in the Abyss. Getting into the top 5 territory, coming number 5 with the title track of Seasons in the Abyss. Seasons in the Abyss. Really one of the first Slayer songs I heard. I remember when Metal Mania was on VH1, I would record on a cassette, and when this song came on, I was just like, just watch that shit all over and over again. Just fucking great stuff. So number 4, I have South of Heaven. Fantastic song, a fantastic record. Number 3, Mandatory Suicide, just one of the best fucking Slayer songs of all time. Number 2, I have Chemical Warfare, which is a newer song to me, but just kind of what Pete said, like what it started to, you know, one of the first songs that brought the new level of extremity and evil and kind of influenced the rest of their catalog. You can't deny its influence. And number 1 is Angel of Death. What else was going
to
fucking be?
This guy listens to Slayer, bro.
So, yeah, that's going to be it. I hope y'all enjoyed this part 1, because this is definitely a highlight of their career, and the part 2 is a bit of choppy waters, and we'll just leave it at that.
So if I have one criticism before we even publish this episode, it's only that everyone knows that 80s Slayer rules. There's been so many deep dives, like even into individual records, that there's like almost nothing we can add. However, as the peaks that this band reaches in the 80s, the depths they plumb in the albums to come is going to make for an entertaining fucking podcast, let me tell you. And I'm not going to name names, but someone on this panel is mistakenly in love with a certain 90s Slayer record. And there's nothing to love about 90s Slayer.
Hater's gonna hate, motherfucker.
That sounds like lyrics ripped straight from Diabolus and Musica, honestly. Hater's gonna hate. That might have actually been more poignant. Shit gets rough from here on out, dog. I can't wait to talk about it.
It's gonna be hilarious. I'm telling you, there'll be a lot of laughs this upcoming episode.
Has there ever been a greater fall from grace? I mean, I guess Metallica. Like, they were really the big four was really competing to like who could shit on their fans the most in the 1990s. I mean, you think about Load and Reload, Divine Intervention, which at least is Seasons in the Abyss Part 2, just the B-sides, before they get to like Total, Jumping the Shark, Diabolus and Musica. And then like Megadeth, at least they have Countdown to Extinction and Rust in Peace to count for the 90s.
Euthanasia.
And Euthanasia. Like, it's really only fucking a Risk that's kind of an abomination. So they'd probably come out of the 90s looking the best. But it's like, what was up? Like, even Testament tried something new, but I think Testament's the only one who worked trying to go like all death metal with their 90s records. Some people hate them, but I think the Testament 90s record work.
The one Demonic is incredible. I think it was the second one. The Gathering was not as effective, but I mean that first one, I was like, this is fucking underrated. Underrated record for sure.
Yeah. They had the Ritual 92, which is them trying to do the kind of the classic metal thing, which didn't always work, but it does a Return to Serenity, one of the best Testament songs ever. Then there was the Low from 94, which I was one of my first Testament records. I think way underrated. Demonic, you get less of the shit of it. It's not bad, but The Gathering is a lot better. Hell, you had Lombardo on drums, DeGorgio, James Murphy on guitar.
It's like the new Eric classic lineup, essentially, the first time they all got together. Yeah. Really. It's
a fucking great album.
So, yeah. The 90s was a rough time for heavy metal. It was really rough for Slayer, and I can't wait for us to fucking get into it. Don't you oof. I don't want to spoil it. Your time is coming. I've got something written for you.
Duel is wiping down the altar of sacrifice presently.
Good times. Good times ahead, folks. Just wait and see.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of the Fundamentalist Podcast. If you like what we have to say, talk to us. Send some demeaning comments to us on Instagram or whatever other social media that of your choice. We will definitely talk and joke about it on air and off air. That's about all you're getting, though. With that being said, thanks for fucking listening. Leave us a nice review if you feel so inclined on either iTunes or Spotify or wherever the fuck you're getting this podcast, wherever it is and wherever you leave the review, we greatly appreciate it. That I can assure you. For the Fundamentalist Podcast, I am Dual Guess, and signing off, Peter Bogg.
Adios.
And Richard Donahue.
Good evening.
We all thank you. And we will be chatting with you next time, talking about the abomination that is 1990s Slayer and the redemption that is everything else afterwards. Until then, tschüss.